Welcome to this very special edition of Behind the Podcast. Today we have Frank Corva joining us and Rod Palmer as usual. People may know Frank Corva as the guy on Bitcoin Magazine live streams who asks much more interesting questions than Isabella and Rizzo. But yeah, how you guys doing tonight? How you doing, Rod? How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great. Yeah, this is a big episode for, as you know, we take our credentials as journalists very seriously. And we have utmost respect for peers in the industry. And this, I mean, Frank is by far the most esteemed credentialed journalist that we've had the privilege of talking to on this show. He's the chief clinical correspondent, or will be, at Bitcoin Magazine, which is essentially like the front row, or going to be the front row in the White House press corps, you know, probably by the end of the year. So that's going to be great. But yeah, how you doing, man?
Doing well. Shout out to Rizzo and Isabella. Gotta shout out the live stream team there. Doing well. Yeah. God willing, we'll be in the White House press corps sooner than later. Got to do that on behalf of the plebs. Got to showcase the credentials. And yeah, good to be here with you guys this evening. Thank you for having me on.
I have a question. What is your strategy, or how are you approaching it? How are you going to make sure that Shinobi doesn't wear off and make President Trump feel bearish?
Shinobi's, I can't promise anything with Shinobi. I don't really have a strategy. I mean, in a way, Shinobi is kind of like Trump. He's a bit of a wild card. You can't really control him. He's just out there doing Shinobi things, and you just have to appreciate him for that and work with him. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe talk a little bit about opcodes or something, distract him from getting onto getting into Trump's ear and doing telling him bearish things.
Have you warned any of the rest of like Trump's staff and advisors in the Oval Office that Shinobi may, inadvertently or, often call the president a retard?
We haven't warned them. We know that the president is sort of, he's a fan of using, I think, such language. Maybe not that exact word, but,
I think it might make him respect Shinobi. Correct. I think that Shinobi and Donald Trump could honestly have a pretty good relationship, at least a business relationship, because they would both respect each other.
Totally. Even the new sort of communist Shinobi, without a doubt, I think that they would genuinely, there's some level of respect they'd have for each other, no doubt.
Do you think the communist thing is to impress a girl?
Wow, to impress a girl. Which girl?
I don't know. There's a lot of girls on Twitter that think that Shinobi's hot.
Yeah.
And, a lot of them that are coming in, they're a little bit on the liberal side lately.
Mm.
And, maybe has something to do with his politics as well.
Good. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know all the details there, but I mean, the outfit, I mean, if it wasn't initially to impress a girl, the communist outfit, the one I think he had on at, I think he had it on the live stream on Inauguration Day that we did from PubKey, and the one he was wearing at Bitcoin Amsterdam. I mean, if that's not going to impress the ladies, if they weren't already on board, they're definitely on board after seeing that.
I think as far as if you want Shinobi to shift his political ideology, having a communist technical editor might not be the best look for Bitcoin Magazine.
I mean, yeah, please continue. I'm sorry.
Well, especially as Bitcoin Magazine is looking to partner more closely with the decentralized deep state 2.0
right.
The Trump administration is forming. So one thing that's really interesting about the Trump administration that's different than any other administration I've ever seen is that he insists on his press secretaries, his spokespeople, he insists on them being really hot women,
right?
And so if Shinobi is really, if he's become a communist to impress a girl, think about what he would have to do to impress the super-based hot press secretary in the White House.
I mean, This remains to be seen. Again, though, I think it's like a game recognizes game sort of thing. I don't know if it'll be a matter of like political ideology. It'll just sort of be, you know, the same way that Trump and Shinobi, there'll be sort of a mutual respect there. I think that, you know, the super base press secretary has likely, you know, read up on, you know, Covenant's proposals and the importance of Bitcoin not ossifying, and will sort of just inherently, you know, respect Shinobi as a result of that.
So, Frank, you being a credentialed journalist, right, I want to get your take. So the entire media apparatus has been turned upside down with the pausing or elimination of USAID. Joe Nakamoto hasn't been posting tutorials on how to use Tether. Politico,
yep,
is looking like they're bankrupt. The New York Times is in shambles as a loss of their funding. So the average person is waking up to the reality that the media apparatus has essentially been funded by the CIA.
That's right.
This is a big shock. I don't think anybody saw this coming.
Right. Yeah, it seemed very organic what had been going on with news outlets like Politico. And, you know, I think all I can really think about here is the opportunity for us to capitalize on it, right? I mean, I tweeted earlier that it just seems sort of logical that Bitcoin Magazine gets Politico's seat in the White House press room. We're here to represent the true plebs. We're not here to represent the fake, you know, left-wing media plebs or the, you know, the you know, the paid for plebs, the ones that are bought and sold by the deep state. We're not about that, and we're just hoping that maybe justice prevails this time around, and that Trump sees the fact that we are the face of or we are the voice of the you know, the average UTXO holder, and that we get our rightful place in the press corps and in the press room as a result of that.
I'm even more bullish than you about this ability to capitalize, because I think that as we're seeing, like, all these operations, these money laundering campaigns, or, you know, that they have been doing for decades, probably maybe longer, they're all going away. But we all know that the CIA is not going away. They may change their logo.
That's right.
They may change the name, but it's not going away. We're going to have to work hard. We're going to have to pay taxes, and the CIA is going to get those tax dollars, and they're going to try to influence the narrative. And I think that if we get them into podcasting 2.0, value for value, It just realigns these. So we're going to fix the incentives of the CIA. And we're going to be able to transact adversarially with them in the value for value economy, because they will be able to boost Bitcoin podcasts that they want to support, who they think that are sending a good message to how to, you know, these right hardware wallets and protect your Bitcoin from North Korea, the hackers. Right. And like, that's the kind of stuff, because that's the kind of, they'll get boosts. They'll get quality content in return for our tax dollars that they're using to influence us.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see how that wouldn't be the case. And, you know, as the world moves to a Bitcoin standard, I mean, that's going to include members of the CIA. And if we're going to keep the deep state funded, no better way to do that than streaming sats. That's probably the only way to do it, is for them to be earning sats in the process. We know the value the CIA produces for all of us and keeping us safe. So the least we can do is turn them on to the value for value, the V for V model, if you will, and keep them funded so that our freedoms are protected.
Yeah. We talked about this, that, you know, for the longest time, people who use Bitcoin, they thought they were outsmarting, and they'd see the government, like, these guys are dumb. They don't know what I'm doing. I'm not going to have to pay my taxes. But through Bitcoin podcasts, we orange-pilled a lot of feds. And, you know, they're in spaces, they're listening, they're getting the same advertisements that we are. So the feds own cold cards, the feds own treasures and ledgers, and they're using unchained capital, multi-sigs, and they use wallets, you know, all that stuff. So they're learning it, and they're understanding how to use it, and they're going to use it too. And you don't want the feds to just be the only ones using Bitcoin?
No, we don't. Of course we don't want. I mean, Bitcoin is for everyone, right? Bitcoin is for enemies, money for enemies. I think that's the phrase. You know, you just said that they own cold cards, they own Trezor. They might even own these actual companies, right? They might be producing this hardware that we're all using, which is, again, something we should be grateful for.
They may be the ones doing tutorials and teaching you how to use your cold card.
It wouldn't surprise
you. You may get orange pilled by a Fed yourself.
I've spent a little bit of time, speaking of tutorials, with BTC sessions. I definitely caught some Fed vibes.
I did not name BTC sessions. You did, but continue.
Got it. Right. My apologies. Didn't mean to dox anybody there. But wouldn't surprise me. You know, this is a very physically fit man. Looks like he's been through basic training.
Yes.
Frequently posts pictures of himself, how physically fit he is. You just have to think that maybe that didn't happen on his own. Maybe he's got special forces teams that are keeping him in such shape at this ripe old age of 40.
And that's one of the things that terrifies me the most, is because there is not a hardware wallet or a node or a software wallet that BTC Sessions doesn't know how to use.
That's right.
And I don't think there's anybody out there who knows how to use them that didn't learn how to use them by watching BTC Sessions videos and tutorials on it. And it's just, you know, if they know how to use it better than we do, if we're still struggling to consolidate our UTXOs, man, they're going to rockets.
We're falling behind here. There's no question. For all intents and purposes, we might as well all really just be invested only in spot Bitcoin ETFs at this point. Maybe iBit, if you will. The odds of us getting rugged by these people are quite high at this point, which is, again, probably why we should just be more focused on compliant, you know, totally KYC Bitcoin at this point, because the reality that all these tools that we have to work around, the compliance.
It's harder for the CIA to steal your Bitcoin if it's KYC'd.
It seems like that's the case. You know, my credentials aren't 100% up to date. Don't tell anybody. But from what I can tell, based on the research I've done and my level of credentialedness, it does seem that that's the case from my perspective.
Yeah, I mean, so who do I file complaints with about journalistic practices at Bitcoin Magazine? Who's the best point of contact for that?
This is a great question. I know David Bailey is looking to hire someone to do this. Our HR department is currently lacking a bit. Again, we can go back to Shinobi. Shinobi's good to bring this kind of stuff up with. Great with administrative work. Great with using HR appropriate language. Highly credentialed himself, so it's sort of like he's sort of the bar. So if you're not as credentialed as that, he will quickly let you know that is the case. Don't have a name offhand, but just emailing the editor. We'll put you in touch with the right person, editor@btcmedia.org, and we'll get you in touch with the right people.
Shinobi,
Shinobi
will be a phone call right after this.
I was going to say, you know, until we get that new person hired, we could probably just send a DM to Rizzo or Shinobi, and they'll do customer service, basically. If you have complaints about Bitcoin Magazine, they'll be happy to field those.
Happy to do it, I would say, with Rizzo. Just keep in mind that, from what I've heard, he's in the early stages of starting a podcast right now, so he's quite busy. Don't tell too many people about that. So if he doesn't get back to you right away, just know it's because he's hard at work at getting out there on the podcast circuit, not as a guest, but as a host this time around. And Rizzo, Shinobi. One of the two will get back to you eventually, just maybe not right away.
So this is kind of like a long question that I was setting up for, which is I've been very disappointed with the media's coverage of the People's Republic of North Korea.
Mm.
And the reason why is El Salvador has gotten a lot of unfair attention. So Isabella is down there right now.
That's right.
Reporting on Bitcoin's use in El Salvador. I have not seen any reporters go to North Korea to talk about their Bitcoin acceptance.
I think we should, what's really important to acknowledge there is North Korea is sort of the birthplace of hacker culture, if you will. It's where hacker culture is alive and well, and we should really acknowledge that. For the record, I've been there. I've actually crossed the border into North Korea about 10 years ago. At the time, I actually wasn't familiar with what Bitcoin was, though. So it was a bit of a shortcoming on my part. But I think we all owe a lot to the hackers that constantly hack crypto bridges to sort of to show us what they're capable of. Ideally, they crack Bitcoin's code in one day too and get to it. But we really should be showcasing the skills at play amongst their computer savvy and their hacker elite over there, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Like, the North Koreans were using Bitcoin before you even knew what it was.
That's right. I mean, that's correct. They were using it before the advent of blockchain. And, setting a model for the rest of the world to be non-compliant, to do things that are quite, though obviously the hackers there are sort of controlled by the state, they're also quite subversive at the same time. So it's, they were really sort of setting a model for like that sort of deep state meets hacker culture marriage, just that beautiful marriage.
When you were in North Korea, I'm speculating here, but I think I imagine one of the things you would notice is there's not as many chairs there as there are, in the United States. And there's probably not very many, you probably didn't see that many chairs at all. And it's like imagining that, just that stoicism, that discipline, that just of that saving culture.
Yeah.
Of trying to acquire more Bitcoin. It's hard to keep up with a culture like that.
You can't keep up with a culture like that, to be honest. I was only in one room while I was there, and I can report that there were actually no chairs in that room. So when we're talking about really putting your last, the last of your assets, the last of your dollars into Bitcoin to live on that Bitcoin standard, to go all in, if you will, nobody does it better than North Koreans, no question.
Right. Yeah. Especially like you said, like right at the border, where you might have guests, you don't even have chairs for your guests. That's locked in mode, but time preference, very low time preference as well.
Very
low.
Did
you notice that the art and the music was superior because they were living on a Bitcoin standard?
It was almost like this sort of renaissance that you've only read about in books. That was the vibes. Like, again, didn't go too deep into the heart of the country or anything, but the level of it was, you just heard orchestral music wherever you go. The detail on the architecture, stunning. I had never seen anything like it in my life, to be honest.
Absolutely incredible. And I can't believe I've never heard Saifedean ever mention them.
I'd imagine he's gone there. I would imagine that his travels within North Korea were part of the inspiration behind the Bitcoin standard. I've read the book many times, obviously. Like I said, what the world on a Bitcoin standard is like, it's really not a hypothetical in North Korea. And you have to imagine he wasn't writing to speculate what the world could look like on a Bitcoin standard. He was writing based on the greatest model that there is out there, which is the North Korean model, the North Korea on a Bitcoin standard model.
Yeah. I mean, it is a really good like role model for an exclusive. If you're building an exclusive citadel, North Korea is kind of pioneering that.
The whole country's a citadel, I would say. Maybe like citadels within citadels, but it is it's the ultimate model for a state-sponsored citadel. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. I don't think it always has to be a state-sponsored one. So like, I think that Bitcoiners know that real estate is a shitcoin.
Right.
So when we have our citadels, we're going to need landlords. We're going to need somebody to rent houses from. And I don't think that has to be the state. I think it can be BlackRock. They understand Bitcoin. They understand real estate, and they, you know, they could come in and provide housing and things like that and stuff for us to lease.
I think it's really whatever Larry Fink says. You know, in the Bitcoin space, we love Larry Fink now. So I think really whatever he says, whether that's just, you know, him, if he says that him being in charge of all real estate is best for us, the same way, you know, he's talking now about Bitcoin as this amazing universal currency. I mean, he obviously gets it. So, yeah, we just need to sort of follow his lead at this point. I mean, it seems like what the real plebs are doing. So it's, who am I to sort of disagree with that perspective?
No, Larry is a big Bitcoiner. You might listen to this show. You might really appreciate the kind words you said.
Ideally, Larry, if you're listening, thank you for the work you do with Bitcoin. Thank you for, you know, please, with whatever real estate you do rent to me or that your people rent to me. I just want to say thank you in advance. It's so much easier to live in a world where I don't have to worry about owning anything, where I can just rent from you and, you know, your well manicured and well kept properties. So thank you for all you do.
So we're in this very unpredictable and unstable time. Things are shifting incredibly quickly. Do you have any predictions for the next year? We're still pretty early in on the year, but just any macro predictions, any predictions about shifts that we'll see in the media, stuff that normal people.
I would say, could you, I'm thinking more, you have you're pretty close to the policy that is being set, what's going on, what people are talking about, what people are doing. So I think that a lot of people who aren't that close or just, right, you know, maybe you live in the Midwest, you have a normal job, you see a lot of stuff on social media. And you have your expectations, you have your price predictions, you have your whatever, SBR predictions. But do you think that the regular person's predictions are too bullish or too bearish? What would you predict being closer to the source of, you know, significant things that might take place?
You know, I think this is the year. There's little question in my mind that this is the year that the Samson Mao God candle becomes a reality and that we just go straight to a million. We just 10x directly from here. I can't see how that doesn't happen. You know, I've been listening to the likes of Preston Pish and James Lavish for years. And, you know, they've just been so right all along that, you know, we're on pace to get to that $1 million Bitcoin that's coming. You know, I hope that, you know, I'm just assuming that the United States essentially hyperinflates the dollar in efforts to buy as much Bitcoin as possible for the strategic Bitcoin reserve. It seems like the only fair thing to do. To quote Saylor, you know, everybody gets in at the price they deserve. And I think for all the hardworking Americans that haven't gotten in yet, we owe it to them to hyperinflate the money that they earn and save in if it's not Bitcoin, to teach them a lesson and to get them into Bitcoin as soon as possible. So, yeah. I'm predicting Samson Mao God candle comes true within the next few months, or at least by year's end. We're at $1 million Bitcoin. It never comes back down. We don't see a bear market ever again. $1 million Bitcoin is now the new baseline. And we just move into this Bitcoin utopia that all the macro analysts have been sort of, teaching us about for the last, since about 2020, 2021.
Yeah. I have a lot of friends who we talk about Bitcoin and they mention that, like you mentioned, Preston Pish is kind of who orange pilled them. And especially this cycle with MicroStrategy, and, you know, they like when Preston talks about, you know, Michael Saylor has, like, you know, found the infinite money glitch, right? And it just reminds me of my own experience when this last cycle, because I just love Bitcoin podcasts. I would love to listen to Preston explain how much of a slam dunk the GBTC arbitrage was. And it was just such a pleasure to learn about how to make money, you know, going long and short Bitcoin and GBTC at the same time. It was a slam dunk move.
I mean, it was the only play at the time. And if you weren't taking advantage of that arbitrage, I mean, we know that everybody who didn't do that lost. And it was a It was an obvious play. We're grateful to Preston for bringing it to our attention. I'm happy I capitalized on it myself. I'm better off as a result of it. And yeah, we can't say enough about the Bitcoin Macro podcasters. They've opened our eyes to a world of finance meets Bitcoin that we just wouldn't have seen otherwise.
This is the importance of 40 hours per week.
No right question. Here. Yeah, without a doubt. You're talking about consuming upwards of either 40 hours of Bitcoin podcasts or just Bitcoin educational materials, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely.
40 hours of podcast per week. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm not sure what else you would do for 40 hours a week. I mean, with all the information out, with all the brilliance out there, with all of the incredible perspectives, we owe it to ourselves to essentially spend that much time.
I'm always curious to know how people structure their 40 hours per week. Some people, you know, they listen to mostly macro. Some people might listen to, Marty and Odell. They've got several podcasts you do. You have for your 40 hours per week just from those guys. And a lot of people do. And how do you do? How do you break it up? Do you do like 10% privacy podcast, 10% spaces or something? You kind of substitute that for podcasts. What do you do? How do you get your 40 hours? How do you break it down?
I'm glad you brought that up. I think spaces should be included as podcasts. They, live stream spaces, these things, they're okay. I start with some of the basics. You know, thank goodness Danny Knowles has resurrected the greatest Bitcoin podcast that ever was, What Bitcoin Did. We're grateful to Danny for that. So I do a little bit of a broader overview with What Bitcoin Did. Nice range of, cycling in the same 10 guests or so. It's like it's the perfect way to do it. If you're going to podcast, we want to see Lynn there. We want to see, just listen to, Jameson Lopp on there. So just getting, everything from the macro to the safety, to getting your setup correct, all that kind of stuff. I don't do too much of the spaces. I have to host them, so I don't have as much time to spend in the spaces. Sometimes there's a little bit of noise there. I like to keep it just strong signal only. We got NVK's podcast talking about things that are a bit more technical, a little bit more about privacy. That's important. But honestly, it's more of just an intuition thing. I like to see obviously there's Marty and Odell, which we need to listen to as well. I think it's really important that we listen to venture capitalists talk their book when they're talking about different technology that we could use. I think it's important that there's no, that level of partiality is really important for us to know that when people are telling us to use certain products, that they have a stake in those products and that we should be using them because it will financially benefit the people talking about those products. And that's really important for listeners to keep in mind. I just follow my gut, to be honest. I have my Fountain app. I subscribe to all the Bitcoin podcasts on there. I see which tile really tickles my fancy that day, and I just click on that podcast and I get going from there. See where the day takes me.
Yeah, it's hard to describe the feeling when you got the day to yourself and you got several hours listening to podcasts and you open your phone and you got a notification like there's Jeff Booth on What Bitcoin Did. It's like my Saturday afternoon is booked.
That's it.
Nothing's better than Lynn Alden. I mean, it doesn't matter really, honestly, which show she's on. The longer the show, the better. But yeah, we're huge fans of Lynn Alden. I'm here to Lynn Alden is hot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Lynn Alden is everything, if you will. She's a stellar human being, hot, the whole nine. I mean, the greatest macro analyst, an amazing venture capitalist. We're lucky to have her in the space. And as you said, the more podcasts she's on, the better. The longer those podcasts are, the better. And we should make time on our Saturday and Sunday afternoons to listen to her.
I think one of the best things that can happen to Bitcoin. So we should get into Trump a little bit here next, but like just to kind of bring that topic up I think you mentioned something about Donald Trump. There's a lot of people trying to get his attention and he has a pretty short attention span easy to get bored. Yeah. But when I think of who he should be around him to help guide him and counsel him, and I'm trying to think of, well, Trump respects a girl who's hot and is really smart. I think Lynn Alden has never had any problem holding somebody's attention when she's talking about macroeconomics, and having her almost like having private podcast session, Bitcoin podcast session, macro discussions with President Trump, I think that we would really be able to catch his attention. I think that he's, you know, he promised the SBR, the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, first day, spent a couple weeks. You know, he's got, while he's doing a lot of things, you know, some people are worried that occupying the Gaza Strip will distract him from the SBR. I don't think so. I think he'll get to it, but I think Lynn Alden would be a real sage advice for him.
No question. And as far as the SBR, to quote Lynn Alden, nothing stops this train. The SBR is happening one way or another. It's a mandate from heaven at this point, and it's going to happen regardless. I think Lynn would be great as maybe, I think you were hinting at maybe her being a bit of an economic advisor to Trump. I think that would be perfect. You know, I think she has a real ability to sort of distill information in a way that would keep Trump's attention. You know, at the same time, I've heard she likes cheeseburgers and Trump likes cheeseburgers. So, I mean, they'll have that. It seems like a no-brainer to have Lynn in there sort of explaining to Trump, you know, just the way he needs to be thinking about Bitcoin, you know, especially as a macro asset, not necessarily as money, but really as an investable asset and something that will keep the United States and the deep state afloat.
You know, one of the things we talked about when we started here is, like, it's going to be crazy. Like, your replay, Bitcoin Magazine is kind of becoming like the state-run media. And it was the state-run media that we had before 2025 was the worst time, the kind that basically was on the fiat standard, not the Bitcoin standard. But in this case, like, David Bailey in Bitcoin Magazine kind of saw this coming, and they kind of propelled the president to power. President Trump owes Bitcoiners. So it's the state-run media, but Bitcoin Magazine has equity in this administration. They have equity in the state now. So it is not this, you know, predatory, untrustworthy relationship. It's, you are now able to be pumped into the Oval Office, into the White House, and you'll be able to tell the plebs and Bitcoin podcasters what's going down.
This is the magic of what's going on and what David has done. So yes, we'll be able to not only sort of tell the plebs what's going on from the White House perspective, but be the voice of the plebs in the White House, right? In the White House, in the press room, at press conferences with our crypto czar, David Sachs. You know, and I think that there's really no greater honor. I think what David has done for the Bitcoin community in getting us to that sort of place where we could truly speak on behalf of your everyday Bitcoiner and make sure that the president is hearing their words through us as a vessel is tremendous, because there's no question that Trump isn't going to listen to every single word we said, that, you know, we just have to speak up a little bit more to maybe to explain to him that, you know, being on the Bitcoin standard is the way to go, and that all this talk of stable coins that maybe you heard yesterday really isn't the way to go. Once we can fully get our voices heard, we know that we're going to change direction there, and that, you know, Bessent and all of this talk about stable coins and how it's a great way to sort of have these companies sort of hold these treasuries and buy treasuries, that whole plan will be abandoned, despite the fact that Elon is now talking about putting treasuries on the blockchain. We will get all of that changed, you know, again, thanks to David's work.
Right. Like, you don't want to tokenize and call the token a U.S. treasury, because then it's going to be so compliant. You have to change the logo and you have to call it something else, like Tether or USDC was stupid. And that's why USDC sucks. It is like, it's being too obvious that it's the dollar.
Totally.
You gotta have a cool name for it, but like Tether is good enough.
Yeah.
And you still have treasuries on the blockchain, but you just don't, the congressman, some 70-year-old, he doesn't, you know, He's too retarded for that. Like, he doesn't know what Tether is. So they don't try to make it compliant. But, you know, putting, you know, so.
I'd like to make a point about Tether. I'd like to say that Tether essentially, I think, is Bitcoin at this point. Now that Taproot Assets and what Lightning Labs have done by bringing Tether to Bitcoin and Lightning, I'd like to sort of maybe, you know, I think it's given Tether a new edge. Some of us have been a little bit hard on Tether. But I think now, just given how close it is technologically to Bitcoin, I like to sort of think of it as something, you know, it's a lot cooler again. Tether on Tron wasn't so cool. Forget about something like USDC. That's been sort of vanilla and uncool from day one. But, you know, I think Tether in this rebranding that it's doing, you know, I saw Paolo Arduino the other day post this amazing video of this big sort of ominous, cool building that they're going to build in, I think it's in El Salvador, Tether headquarters or something. And Michael Saylor, actually, you know, he was talking about the importance of maybe Tether coming to New York, just being this sort of stablecoin king. You know, I think Tether's in it's in the middle of shout out to Mark Goodwin while I'm talking about Tether. You know, I think Tether is in the middle of a rebrand that maybe even the likes of Mark, you know, just weren't ready for. And, you know, now that it's so intimately tied in with Bitcoin, you know, I think its best days are ahead of it.
They're pretty aggressively investing in growing Rumble as well as like a YouTube competitor and adding Tether payments to content creators, which will be a huge boon for the Global South. Tether on Tron being able to monetize their content. You know, what you said about Mark really resonated with me. What I've been thinking is that Tether is going to impress Mark and win him over by, because Mark, he talks about treasuries and the Merkle route. And one of the things I talked about earlier was that the feds are, you know, they're learning, they're getting orange pilled too. And right now we just had the mempool cleared. It seems like we just, with especially with the Orgamals, especially with Duty and the shitcoiners, we're having a real hard time figure out how to balance and value UTXOs.
Yeah.
And how to use that block space. And I think Tether is going to come in and be like, listen, we're going to use the dollar and we're going to provide Bitcoin with these services because we figure out how to value and use UTXOs better than everybody else did. And that's, it's going to be such a bullish event that I think Mark will finally kind of admit that the Tether is good for Bitcoin.
100%, and that the real purpose of Bitcoin is to strengthen the U.S. dollar, which is what we're talking about with the SBR here. We're going to inflate, you know, we're gonna make sure that the dollar stays strong. You know, I think the Global South, they need it, right? You know, who needs Bitcoin when you can have something that's completely permissioned, that's so well run by a company like Tether, that's so just remarkably stable. And I think that Mark, you know, he DM'd me earlier. He's starting to see this. He obviously has been a bit critical. You know, wrote that amazing book, The Bitcoin Dollar, and I think that you know, at first there was a lot of negative connotation, you know, with what he was talking about here, but he's really starting to come around to it and starting to understand, you know, when Paolo Arduino says that he's a Bitcoiner, you know, Mark wasn't taking those words at face value. And I think he's starting to see that Paolo really is a Bitcoiner.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Paolo, one of his shortcomings is he doesn't go on enough podcasts. He's too busy getting dollars in the hands of the Global South.
No question. Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, male version of Mother Teresa in a way. He's, you know, single-handedly saving the Global South by getting, you know, more dollars in their hands. And yeah, he does a fair share of conferences, though. I've seen Paolo at conferences adopting Bitcoin. I think he was just at Plan B, and obviously they co-sponsored that in El Salvador. So while he's not necessarily super strong on the podcast circuit, definitely doing the conference circuit. And what I like is that, you know, he's not very approachable at these conferences. There's a mystique. He's sort of like a rock star, if you will. He's out there. He's a man of the people, but difficult to approach at the same time. oddly enough. A strange juxtaposition, but he plays the role well.
If you're one of the biggest owners of U.S. treasuries in the world, you kind of have to be unapproachable. You know what I mean?
I think that's fair. Yeah, it's sort of the equivalent of owning a lot of Bitcoin and not wanting to get wrench attacked. You have to just sort of keep yourself in the background, you know, keep a low profile and stay hard at work. And you're obviously, the work you're doing is the Lord's work. You don't necessarily have to be out there with the people shaking hands, but just keeping that low profile, keeping your head down, doing what you need to do.
I think one of the biggest challenges for lobbyists right now, or well, let me set this first before I go into that. One of the tactical mistakes that Corey Clipston made in working with Tether was he did not wait for Tether to be on Lightning. He jumped in trying to use dollars to make Bitcoin stronger when it was still primarily used on Tron and Ethereum.
That's right.
It was a very big tactical mistake. Now, one of the challenges that lobbyists have right now, and I know the Bitcoin Policy Institute, I know Dennis Porter, they're working very hard on this, David Bailey as well. The challenge is, as they attempt to put the government on the blockchain, is how do we get them to do that on the Bitcoin blockchain instead of an altcoin blockchain?
Yeah. Taproot assets, you know, again, the model now being set with Tether, what Elizabeth Stark and Ryan Gentry have pulled off here, just absolutely stunning. You know, shout out to Corey, was a visionary in partnering with Tether, maybe just a little bit early, as you said. You know, just Tether was still doing its Tron thing, a little bit of Ethereum. Some people are just early. You know, it doesn't mean they were wrong. They're just a little bit early. So I think with Corey, that was the case. We appreciate it. Yeah.
The true visionary, I mean, Jack Mallers and Strike partnered with Tether in like 2020, 2021. You know, they didn't brag about it. They didn't go around like making everybody else feel embarrassed because they weren't smart enough to do it too. They just kept their head down and built just a great, you know, way to a great Lightning network to really help the dollar grow.
Yeah.
A real foundation for the dollar to kind of spark interest in people's minds in the global south. And then, they started building on Tron and other networks. But, you know, you could definitely say that Strike was one of the early people down there educating and onboarding the global south and onto Tether. And it's, you know, they don't get enough respect for that.
No question. Yeah. I mean, deep down, you know, Jack is a Bitcoiner, but he loves the dollar just as much. And that's something that often doesn't get said a lot. He's a good American. He loves the dollar.
Right, his closets can't be filled by things you buy with Bitcoin. You don't have dollars for, you know, that.
That's correct. Yeah. And Jack knows that too. You know, he's a bit of a showman. He's out there. He's doing the press circuit. So he's got to say things in a certain light. I think it's up to us plebs to sort of acknowledge what Jack's really about though. And we appreciate, you know, I think again, much like what Mark Goodwin's coming around to, he gets that Bitcoin is here to strengthen the dollar. And it's been clear since 2020 that he gets that. And, you know, he can't say it outright sometimes. We'll say it for him. And we can also say that we appreciate the work he's doing. So, yeah, shout out to you, Jack.
Yeah. If I was Jack, I would, you know, I would maybe say to Corey, it's like, don't impress me with what you're going to do. Just impress me with what you've already done.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think if I had to guess, Jack is impressed with the fact that Corey was early, that he was early to Tether, even though, you know, he might have just missed it by a little bit. Now there's a little bit of beef and the lawsuit and everything like that. I'm sure that'll all be settled. But I think deep down, Jack gets that Corey got it. Again, some, you know, certain visionaries, they're just ahead of their time and it just is what it is. But history will look favorably on the moves that Corey made. And Jack already does, as far as I know.
Yeah, I think everybody can agree that nothing's more cypherpunk than Pacific Bitcoin. So we really want to see that come back.
I mean, I don't know much about what happened this year. I do look forward to seeing it back. Super cypherpunk. I think they had was it Saylor usually headlines over Pacific Bitcoin?
Saylor, Sam Callahan, James Lavish, Greg Foss. I mean, the macro elders are well represented. Lynn Alden's always there.
Yeah.
Preston Pish, of course. And you did a fireside with Sam Callahan and Preston Pish. And that's just the appetizer for Saylor and Max Keiser. You know what I mean?
Amen. I mean, these are the cypherpunks that have been in the trenches since the beginning. And, you know, on top of that, we're lucky enough to also have them as macro analysts. I mean, really, how few sort of cypherpunks / macro analysts are there out there? And they're all at Pacific Bitcoin. You know, hat tip is all I can say there.
You got to throw it up to the people who proved that cypherpunks can wear pleated khakis.
It's a beautiful thing. You know, this actually brings up a really funny point. I was with Aaron Von Weerdum, our editor-in-chief at Bitcoin Magazine, and I think I was wearing a Gap shirt that I got from my local thrift store, and his girlfriend made fun of me for it. She was just like, look at this guy. He looks like, you know, your average Joe sort of thing. He doesn't look counterculture at all. And when I was trying to explain to her, I was like, the new counterculture in Bitcoin is being counterculture. It is the khakis. It is the Gap shirt, right? It's fitting in. It's not necessarily looking different or being antisocial. It's looking like your average finance bro, your average guy who doesn't get Bitcoin. This, I think, is the new way to sort of to be, I guess, a wolf in sheep's clothing, if you will. You know, a cypherpunk in sheep's clothing.
Right. If, you know, you were stumbled upon Luke Dash, or, you know, it's going to be given away pretty quick that this guy is like super cypherpunk, could probably steal my wallet without even like touching the keyboard. They'd go on my Bitcoin. But you see ESC, you see somebody wearing, you know, the Patagonia vest.
Yeah.
And you're like, this guy, you know, he's going to want to talk treasuries, but they don't know what you got in cold storage.
No question. Yeah, there's no question. I think that's the, I think that's the new uniform if you're really trying to sort of keep a low profile, as you should, as we've been warned to, the Patagonia vests, the khakis, you know, it seems like really the only way to go at this point.
One important thing I want to ask you before we wrap up is, what's going on with the Samurai case right now? I know you've been covering that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Samurai case, important case. I'm actually hoping to be able to. I'm spacing right now. I'm forgetting. I think it's Keon who's based out in Pennsylvania. Hoping to actually, when possible, maybe even go visit, have a conversation. But you know, with the Samurai case, whenever I see those guys in the courtroom in the Southern District and outside the courtroom, I try to stress to them the importance of compliance. You know, they made a mistake. And it's time for, you know, they get how important compliance is at this point. And I think the judge can see that they're sorry for what they did, that they want to be compliant, and you know, and it'll be all good. I think that they're sort of going through their reconciliation process, and it should be all right. You know, and I think also I do plan to bring this up with the Trump administration when I get to ask my questions, either to our crypto czar or to Trump himself or his press secretary. You know, I think the samurai devs have realized, you know, that it's not that big a deal for people to be identified on the blockchain. Bitcoin is pseudonymous, right? It's not purely anonymous. And I think that they're just at peace with that. They get that at this point. They're not, you know, they get that Bitcoin didn't really need to be mixed. It was something that some people wanted, but it wasn't really a necessity. And given how much of a presence there is of CIA and deep state in the Bitcoin space at this point, you know, it's just sort of a foregone conclusion that they're going to be able to trace any transactions we make anyway. And the Samurai guys get that. And, you know,
You know, I think that I'm hoping that we've kind of reached an inflection point. So Donald Trump's, what he's going to do with these restructuring in the federal government is we're going to go back to the way it should be, which is now that we have other options like Solana for meme coins.
Yeah.
Now, instead of the CIA trying to blackmail or trying to entrap, you know, Bitcoin entrepreneurs and open source enthusiasts of like Sam, right?
Yeah.
And they're just going to be able to take their activity, their, you know, CIA covert ops, and just go pump and dump meme coins in third world countries.
Totally.
And get their money that way and just leave us alone.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I'm hoping that happens. And I think all this concern about KYC in compliance will be fine because we won't be going after taxpayers.
They'll be distracted with something else. Like you said, there's two routes we could really take here, right? There's a value for value route. We don't know if that's going to work with the CIA. We touched on that earlier. The pump and dump route, we know that that's really the best, that, you know, that's the best way if we're just, what are we all really here for, right? Short-term gains. We want to get our bags pumped. And the CIA with all their resources, you have to imagine that they're good at pumping bags. They're good at messaging and getting people on board with the message in the short term, pump the bags, meme coin on Solana, boom, salaries paid for the year. Everything's good.
Right.
We can leave the devs alone.
Think about it.
Yeah.
What better way to improve and increase our influence, especially related to China in the global South and Africa and all these other countries, then by pumping the CIA pump and dumps meme coins, and then they start to make money, they start to financialize and then build that infrastructure, and then everybody's going to need, you know, Tether on Lightning or Tether on Tron, and so they're going to start, their economies are going to become stable coin tetherized,
boom,
and it's going to increase demand for U.S. Treasuries. It's going to make it easier for us to keep spending money. And keep borrowing money so we can save in the strategic Bitcoin reserve.
Yeah.
So when the dollar collapses, we have all the Bitcoin.
Correct.
You know, and they were chasing meme coins.
Yeah. I mean, the
perfect.
The main thing about Bitcoin is that it was put here. You know, I think people get it wrong. Bitcoin came out of the financial collapse of 2009, 2008. But it wasn't put here. You know, people get there's this idea, this narrative, if you will, that Bitcoin was here to challenge the dollar because the dollar was being abused by the powers that be. It's not. It was here. It's here to strengthen the dollar, and it's here to strengthen the United States so that it can continue to cause financial catastrophes around the world and always have a way out. That's really what we're here for, and that's what Bitcoin is here for when it comes to the United States. Yeah.
And now that Tether's on Bitcoin, we can deploy Bitcoin miners all over the world, and we can set those up and we can consume all the energy from all these foreign countries by mining Bitcoin, and then to compensate them, we give them Tether on Lightning.
That's it.
And they can, you know, and it's the perfect trade.
You know, it's Michael Saylor was one of the first people to see this, you know, this idea that the point of Bitcoin is for the U.S. to stockpile it, not use it. It's an asset. It's a capital asset. It's not money. And that we have now, I think he had a great idea. He wanted to get Goldman Sachs involved. He wanted to get other people involved, not just Tether, but other people issuing stable coins as well. Some of the actors, you know, that caused the financial collapse, now giving them maybe a second chance, if you will, to issue stable coins, right? To work hand in hand with the Treasury, Scott Bessent, and a lot of his, you know, he's got a lot of connections in the financial world. He was in the private sector for a while. And I think, it really, that world, the world of traditional finance really deserves a second chance, right? The Treasury, the Fed, it all deserves a second chance. Stable coins are really the way for us to do that. And Bitcoin can just be this thing that we sort of hold on to in case things go awry again, in case things fall apart again.
They say America is the land of second chances.
That's right.
Like when a politician commits a war crime, they are forgiven. When a politician commits human rights violation, like vaccine mandates or something like that, they're forgiven. They're pardoned.
Yeah.
When Ross Ulbricht goes to prison, he's pardoned.
Yeah. It's a great country. It's a great country, America. And it's incredibly important that the people, you know, that have engineered financial collapses get pardoned as well. I mean, there's very little difference between those people and some of the people that you just mentioned. And Bitcoin should just be here to backstop it all. It should just be here as a, you know, a money of last resort. And then we should accumulate as much of it as possible so that we always sort of have a bit of a get out of jail free card for, you know, for some of these actors.
Yeah. I mean, it really is fascinating that Satoshi put a reference to the 2000 financial crisis in the first Bitcoin block, because if anything, that's just him predicting the forgiveness that Bitcoin would offer these people, right?
Yeah. It was a shout out to the chancellor, if you will. Some people think it was a critique of the scenario, whereas I think it was more saying, we're here to support you. We're here to backstop you. I've created something new that you should accumulate as much of as possible on the state level, at the nation state level. Hold in your coffers. I got you was basically what that first inscription said. It was, you're all good.
Now, Richard, do you have any more questions before we get into the fountain boost?
Well, I think we already, I think before we started recording, we asked Frank. So there's two questions we do before we read the fountain boost. So, the first question is, did you listen to the last episode? And you haven't.
I haven't. The last episode I listened to of you guys was something around the holiday season. And I forget what the episode was, but it was a few weeks ago.
They sound like the Christmas special, yeah.
The Christmas special, that's what it was, yeah. Yeah.
The second question is, because we're trying to be, you know, balanced with the type of guests we have on the show. The second question is, are you Jewish?
It's a great question. No, Roman Catholic, you know, Irish Catholic. Well, half Italian, half Irish by descent. So, but yeah, Catholic. Sorry.
How does that? How does your, you know, flavor of Catholicism differ from Luke's? Gash. He thinks the Pope is a shit winner.
Yeah.
He calls him a scammer.
Yeah. I think Luke's a better Catholic than I, from what I can tell. And, you know, I don't want to take any, when it comes to Catholicism, I don't want to take any spotlight away from Luke. I know how serious he is about it. And, you know, I appreciate him bringing that to the Bitcoin space. You know, I think, you know, they're, you know, while we're here separating money from state, we should be bringing religion to money. And I think Luke does that best. So,
yeah. He's famous for doing that with his old mining pool, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, I did actually, I was just scrolling. I was on the train before we did this. I did actually see the title of this episode here that you guys just brought up on the screen. So protecting your daughters from Breedlove's orange pill. Yeah. I think looking forward to listening to this. Is there a guest on this one, or are you guys just sort of chewing the fat here about Breedlove and his relationship with women?
Yeah, we had a very drunk barn miner on our show.
Nice.
So this is one of the segments that we're doing, which is interesting. So like, I think this is our ninth show, right, Rod? Or ninth behind the podcast.
Yeah, that sounds right. I just can't see the number in the title.
Yeah, I can't see it either. Let me see if I can. Wow. Okay. Well, Fountain only gives you so many letters.
So many characters, Jim. Either way.
I think it was the ninth episode. So we're one out of nine for our guests who listened to our last show. So this is always really interesting, making our guests listen to our Fountain boost from the previous show when they haven't heard it.
It
makes it, it's actually kind of interesting. It's like wading into uncharted territories.
I'm ready for it.
Yeah. If you go back and listen, I think Temple would, I think one of our, my favorite of our interviews here was with Rob Hamilton. We talked about Anchor Watch and Miniscript, of course.
Yeah. Rob's a legend. Shout out to Rob and to Becca and to Miniscript. I think, was it Rob that invented Miniscript. I think you guys might have mentioned that. Did you guys break that news,
actually? Well, he discovered it.
Got it. Okay.
But we weren't sure if it was invented or he just, you know.
If he just discovered it, like Bitcoin itself, as some people have pointed out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Got it.
This is one of the hard challenges when you're an innovator, is determining whether you invent or discover things.
It's borderline impossible to tell the difference sometimes. You know, mm-hmm. I think that was definitely the case with Bitcoin itself. When you're as bright as Rob, I would imagine it becomes virtually impossible to tell the difference between when you're just stumbling upon things and when they're just falling out of your mind. So,
yeah, I like to think that memes are discovered, not invented. The only time that I hate that is when Dan Held is stealing memes.
Yep, as he's known to do. Yeah,
it's like I wish they were invented, so he would be in trouble for that. But you know,
copyrighted. Copyright the memes, maybe, so that Dan Held can't take advantage of that. Yeah, that'd be ideal.
Well, the PodConf Twitter account actually they trademark and copyright and reserve like all of their content. So if Dan Held tries to steal a PodConf meme, he's screwed.
Yeah, but hopefully Elon will direct those payment splits for influencers using AI to discover like who stole the meme.
Yep.
Hmm.
That's ideal as well. Yeah, that would be ideal.
Well, to give you some context to the last show we did. So I found Barnminer. Barnminer, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's an individual who mines Bitcoin in a barn.
Okay.
And he has a lot of opinions about things. But on the episode, we talked about like the differences between your daughter and your son getting orange-pilled, right?
Right.
So, like, typically, you know, your son, 16 years old, he gets orange-pilled. You feel pretty good about it. But typically, you want to wait. Like most fathers, they want to either curate the right person to orange-pill their daughter.
Mm.
There's a lot more scrutiny on who their daughter's getting orange-pilled by.
Right.
Or they want them to wait until they're, you know, fully adults, whatever age they arbitrarily determine that is.
Right.
Or maybe not arbitrarily, but it's kind of unique depending on the individual.
And
some people are adults when they're like 17 years old or younger. And some people
are. Like we said, it was like Barnmeyer is really proud of his son. He is 14 years old and he's already a taxpayer. It's like, that's a good dad right there.
Yeah, that's
right. Got his son paying taxes before he can drive.
Compliant. It's great. You know,
our first boost is from Fundamentals. All I can see on here is a fish logo, but he says Barn is a goat. Great. I think, Frank, there's this whole media ecosystem I don't think you're aware of.
I think sometimes my level of credentials sometimes blind me to some of the work that the plebs are doing, some of the independent media out there. As Bitcoin Magazine is becoming mainstream, I think I probably owe it to myself to spend a bit more time to see what's happening in the independent media scene.
Well, I think it's hard because I don't know if you're familiar with Bitcoin Podcast Power Law.
Yeah.
But you are. Okay, cool.
I see BitPain post a lot about the power law. I've heard about it, but I don't know. I haven't listened yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So Bitcoin Podcast Power Law is kind of the evolution of Bitcoin Power Law. So Bitcoin Power Law, I don't know, believes that the guy Giovanni or whatever his name is, believes he's come up with some sort of mathematical way to determine the Bitcoin price.
Right.
But what he's failing to see is that the biggest driver of Bitcoin price appreciation is Bitcoin podcasters.
Yeah.
Because the more people.
Yeah. It's a variable that he just hasn't factored into the equation yet. But when he does, it'll become airtight. The model will become airtight.
Mm-hmm. I think you're familiar with Fundamentals, actually. I was talking to him today and he mentioned DNA, but, or maybe that was the other person I was talking to.
Yeah.
But anyways, Fundamentals is a Bitcoin podcaster. The question is, as there's more podcasts, what is the best way to consume all the podcasts? Because how long have you been interested in Bitcoin or around it?
About going on about 7 years now.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So
I think my answer to that question is that we're truly the luckiest community, because I think Bitcoin podcasts are sort of becoming like grains of sand on the beach. They're just infinite, and that it's better that we maybe never get to the end of it. We can't, you know, I'm a big fan of maybe double timing it, listening in double speed to absorb as much as possible. But I think we're lucky that there's virtually no end, and which means that we can be learning about Bitcoin via podcasts from now until the day we die. And we won't have listened to them all, which is really a gift if you think about it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges as a podcast listener is I listen to a podcast, and every time I do, I question if I could hear more signal somewhere else.
That's fair. Yeah, I think it's always good to be evaluating level of signal. I guess I would have to throw that question back to you. What is your criteria for when you feel that you're experiencing or absorbing signal? How do you know what the signal is and what it feels like?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit different for me because I'm a credentialed journalist. So I'm actually trained in the art of sniffing out signal.
Right.
But I would imagine for the average individual, it's generally signal means there's something actionable.
Okay.
For them to like use. Something that's like important to inform their view on the world and be able to adjust their strategy based off of that.
I like that. Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, I mean, I think we'd be lucky if, you know, given the volume of podcasts, you know, be lucky to, if there was so much signal and all that. I mean, just think about how hard we'd be making it on the CIA and all of the others who are after our stack and who want to know the size of our stack, if we were really absorbing all that signal, if that's the way that you define it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there needs to be more ways for people to listen to podcasts adversarially.
Mm. Would listening to podcasts adversarially maybe be listening to at the same time in tandem, like a bit of a, almost like a conflict in the amount of information, the way that the information is being broadcast, just like really trying to sort of differentiate, to absorb two different signals at once, if you will, different signals on different topics at the same time?
I think there's multiple ways to look at this. So there's the standpoint of privacy, right?
Mm.
So you don't want the CIA to necessarily know which types of information you're consuming.
That's
especially
right.
On certain subjects.
Yep.
Like, so I think there are ways that we can go about this. We can create distributed networks of individuals actually physically mailing cassette tapes around to each other podcasts.
Yeah.
And using tools like remailers and PO boxes.
Yep.
It becomes very difficult to track from that standpoint. That's one way to do it adversarially. And then there's also the adversarial way of, what if there's censorship via these podcast hosting platforms or controls over the internet or just the type of censorship through curation in different algorithms?
Yep.
And we could bypass that actually by transmitting podcasts over radio waves to each other.
Yeah. Either or, really. Cassette tapes, mail, radio waves. These are obvious.
Right. And you could just take, the payment splits of the RSS and the timestamps, and then you could play it over the radio waves, and you use the radio frequencies with maybe some other map, like based on the timestamps, excuse me, once you synced it, and then you could pay the payment splits based on who's talking, just by hearing on the radio waves and having the data available to you.
No question. Maybe in the liner notes, for example, if you're mailing a cassette, you sort of have the LN URL of the people that you should be sort of sending the royalties to, and you sort of give them a little blast, give them a little boost as you're listening to the tape.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about the possibilities in a low fee environment like this. Like, you could actually have a seed phrase on the cassette tape that acts as a boost.
Yeah.
So you could like record a podcast on a cassette tape and then send it to a podcaster, which acts as a boost for their podcast, and then they send one back and forth like that. I think that would be pretty interesting.
I think that's a brilliant idea. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, but you can also use Bitcoin to pay your taxes in a lot of different states, thanks to Dennis Porter. And now you can do it with Tether on Lightning. So it's just very easy and convenient to, you get me, you could stream your taxes to the government all year while you're working. It can be that easy. You wouldn't have to think about it anymore. But yeah.
That's the idea. And I think that that's actually the best way for us to add to the strategic Bitcoin reserve. I don't know why more people aren't talking about this idea that the government doesn't necessarily have to print money. We don't want to do too much of that because given that we want to keep the global South on dollars, we want to be able to strengthen those dollars by streaming the government our taxes for the SBR, for the purpose of right. the SBR.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is on a mission to onboard, a billion new taxpayers all around the world. What better way than to just take a cut of all the crypto transactions overseas? So by using Bitcoin, by using Tether, in the global scenario, any country, you are able to contribute, and be able to afford your taxes and help the United States.
And what I like particularly about Tether in this regard is that if you don't agree with Trump's strategy here, which we should all just blindly agree with, Tether, what really differentiates it from Bitcoin and what makes it so valuable in a situation like this is we could just freeze it if people don't agree that this is a great idea. We could just freeze it and say, hey, look, we came up with this great solution. And when we think about permissionlessness, what we're really talking about is, we have this permission. We're supposed to be listening. We should be listening to the wisdom of someone like Trump who gets Bitcoin, who gets Tether, who has a plan, right? Promises made, promises kept. They're going to follow through on the crypto plan. And if we don't, it's his right to freeze transactions. And I think, that's the beauty of now having Tether on Bitcoin, to be able to, with Bitcoin, not being able to freeze certain transactions, it creates a scenario where the plan might not work out, and we need this sort of plan to work out. We need this sort of vision to become a reality.
It's the beauty of Bitcoin protecting our democracy.
Just think, if Trump understood, that he could go streaming live on Truth Social or put out a short podcast, and his supporters understanding the value for value community and economy would stream him sats, to whatever wallet he set up. I think you'd really appreciate that. I think you'd really respect that.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, I was there when he made that first payment for burgers at PubKey. He saw the magic of Lightning in that moment. The next phase of that is seeing what podcasting 2.0 looks like, seeing what getting stream sats with, effortlessly receiving sats. He saw what it was like to effortlessly, make a payment with them. Now when he's on the other side of that equation, that's when it all comes full circle, and the true value of Bitcoin is realized in his eyes, and it just becomes a bigger part of his strategy.
I think this is one of the beauties of having failed Lightning transactions right off the bat is it teaches you, it sets the expectation that you have to troubleshoot, right?
Bitcoin often gets paralleled to what we're in the phase of adoption. That's like what the internet in 1998 or something like that. Did every website work perfectly in 1998? No, and we're better people because of it. We're better people because of it. Then, right?
If anybody understands or has the spirit of persistence and overcoming troubles, overcoming roadblocks, it's Trump. So I think that, you know, if, you know, it's going to fail, but he's going to figure it out. But yeah, thank you for the boost, Fundamentals. The next one's from John over at the Uncomfortable Misfits. He says, LC and Frito2x did the Blue Collar Pleb podcast. Frito has recently launched his own solo podcast. So we were talking briefly on the last week's podcast about these two people, LC and Frito. And we kept thinking that they were on the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast. But that is not the podcast they're on. That is two firemen from Chicago. But they were on the Blue Collar Plebcast, which we don't know why they named it that.
Right.
After the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast was already out in one of the biggest logos on Found. It's just confusing. But apparently LC has disappeared. I don't know any more details than that, except that Barn Miner was drunk and said that LC has since disappeared. Nobody's heard from him for a few years, and Frito, instead, you know, I guess he gave up looking for him and just decided to start his own podcast.
Mm.
Do you think they named it Blue Collar Plebcast as kind of like an affinity scam? Kind of like
Ethereum
Classic or Bitcoin SV?
You know what I think what I got from that was, so the Blue Collar, I'm not sure what the initial one was. What was it? The Blue Collar, what is the
Bitcoin podcast?
Yeah, the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast. You know, great program. Kind of feel like it's almost become mainstream at this point. And I think putting pleb into a title with blue collar makes me think of the time I spent in the music industry. It's like, you know, when certain bands get so popular, sort of, you're sort of doing something in the same spirit here, but you're bringing it back to the people. You're bringing it back to the independent roots. And so shout out to the Blue Collar Plebcast for doing that. You know, shout out to the great work the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast has done. You know,
I thought with that story about the disappearing podcaster, it just made me wonder, and I don't think there's any right or wrong answer. I think it's different, but if you are a Bitcoin podcaster and you have a co-host who disappears, dies, something like that, you just don't know for sure, but what is like the etiquette for how long you wait before? I mean, you're a podcaster. That's what you do. Do you take time? Do you come back? How long do you wait before you start another podcast? How long do you wait if you, you know, think there might come back?
I don't mean to sound insensitive here, but, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is TikTok next block. Does Bitcoin stop producing blocks is really the question I ask myself. And I think we should sort of act accordingly, act as, you know, that should be our model. And, you know, while we may miss our fellow podcaster or our co-host for our podcast, you know, we can maintain faith that they come back and that we find them or what have you. But there are plebs out there that need to be educated, that need signal, and we'd be remiss to not be there for them. So,
yeah, personally, if something happened to me and I disappeared, I would want Richard to do the next episode. Don't break schedule. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's what's best for, you know, I like I said, I could wax poetic forever about Bitcoin podcast, but I think the USA, like all this stuff in the news, and I've been saying this for a while, is the best way to help your community is not to donate to charity, because charities are just these fake money laundering fronts.
That's right.
Maybe only a few, it's all a scam, but donating by boosting sats to Bitcoin podcasters.
Yeah.
It helps them create better content. It helps other people find that content, and that content orange pills you and you fix your community. So Don't give to charity, give to Bitcoin podcasters.
No question. Yeah. I think that's like a, it's almost a bit of like a teach a man to fish sort of thing. So like value for value model, right? When you're just giving money to charity, you know, are these people really doing anything, you know, for that right. money? So with Bitcoin podcasters, we know the sort of work that goes into making a Bitcoin podcast, and we're honoring that work. We're letting people know mm-hmm. that we're here to provide value or hard-earned sats for people who are out there educating the masses about Bitcoin.
Right. I said, just I had this tweet the other day. It was people really liked it. I said, if you give a woman Bitcoin, she can go shopping for a day. If you teach a woman how to stack sats, she can go shopping for the rest of her life.
Boom! That's all I have to say there. That's a banger. Yeah.
So thank to say that was 2,100 sats from John, and he also hit the next boost, also for 2,100 sats. Saying, I've seen Barn Miner much drunker.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I see we have in our next boost, the one after that one here. What is that, a V for V shout out?
Oh, yeah. That's pies. So if you ever get on, I don't know if you get on Fountain much, but if you do, or you're on Nose for much and you come across pies, you will start to see that pies is the MVP, like number one Bitcoin podcast listener.
Wow.
And the proof is on it. The proof is on found. He boosts and listens to every single podcast on there.
That's,
I mean, I'm looking a new up. Episode comes out and he's listened to it and boosted within 5 minutes.
You know, I don't know how I'm not following Pies, and I just followed him on Nostra. I don't mean to be rude here while I'm looking down at my phone, but anybody who puts in that sort of work, I want them in my orbit. So
totally.
Yeah.
Hardest working podcast listener I've ever seen.
Yeah. Shout out to Pies. Thank you for your efforts.
So yeah, so that concludes the boost for the show. I want to thank you for coming on, Frank. Is there anything you want to close with? Any messages for the listeners?
No, you know, it's I want to thank you guys for having me on. Thank the listeners for supporting Rod and Richard here as they do God's work, you know, true plebs, if you will. High signal coming out of this podcast, coming out of their Twitter handles. We gotta keep it up. We got a lot of work to do. We gotta stay focused on, you know, on not necessarily focusing on, you know, solving problems with Bitcoin. Those things, you know, it'll find its way. It's really just continuing to have these conversations. That's the most important thing. And then obviously, you know, shooting those boosts over, you know, to acknowledge how important these conversations are, and to show people that we appreciate the value that you guys are providing here.
At the end of the day, I agree with that 100%. At the end of the day, TikTok next block.
Yep.
Bitcoin doesn't care. Bitcoin will be there. But only if we don't stop talking about it.
That's right. Yeah. Nobody's going to learn about this, you know. Nobody's going to really understand this. And more important than understanding it technically or how to use it philosophically, really, that's the most important thing. We've learned that from Breedlove. If we don't have a deep philosophical understanding of what Bitcoin is and how important it is in the world, then really right. all is lost, essentially. So.
Right. And if I said Bitcoin will be there forever.
Correct.
But what good is Bitcoin? What use is Bitcoin if there's nobody using it to spend Tether?
Correct. Yeah. And most people miss that. Yeah.
The very last question I want to ask you before we close. Do you have any big predictions? I know the next big conference Bitcoin Magazine is putting on is in Vegas, but the news leaked today that they're working on the next conference happening in Gaza in 2026.
You know, I can't say what I know. I can either confirm nor deny that based on what I said, you know, but I can say that from the conversations I've had with programming on the conference team, shout out to Craig and McShane, this is going to be like the most deep state level conference you've ever seen in Vegas. We're talking members of government. We're talking, you know, other government employees that you don't even know who are government employees, they'll probably be there in attendance just the same way we got feds in the spaces. We're really trying to sort of put the state front and center at this next Bitcoin conference. We hope you can be there to join us for that, because Bitcoin is here to strengthen the state, and we're here to honor that with the Bitcoin conference.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, 100% the most compliant Bitcoin conference here. Period.
I mean, we're going to have, from what I understand, I suggested the mayor of I just recently did an interview with the mayor of Vancouver, and I suggested, maybe doing a fireside chat with him to McShane. And McShane said, I don't know if we're going to be able to fit him in. So the mayor of a major metropolitan city in North America, we got so much state, so many people who are important to the state that will be at the Bitcoin conference, that we don't know if we're going to have space for someone like that. I mean, we're doing our job. We're doing it to the best of our ability. And, we're finally getting the attention of the right people.
Oh, yeah.
Before we go, really makes me think that Canada so badly right now could use a Canadian Dennis Porter.
No quote. Oh, never thought about that. I think if we ask Dennis, how he always sort of posts about the flights he's taken to whatever state he's going to, talking about how what an honor it is to serve Bitcoin. If we asked him to go to Toronto, to Vancouver, I don't think he'd say no. I think he'd be just as happy, to bring Bitcoin to North America as he would to just bring it to the United States. So I think that's something we should consider.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Dennis Porter.
Hopefully he'll be speaking in Gaza.
Ideally. Yeah.
I don't think he's speaking in Vegas, but hopefully he'll be speaking in Gaza. Well, thank you, Frank, for coming on. We really appreciate your time, your credentials, your wisdom.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you guys for the work you do, for being such incredible credentialed journalists. Just continuously, browbeating people about the importance of Bitcoin and Tether and all other freedom tech out there.
Yeah, sometimes, you spend years trying to orange pill people and trying to be polite, but eventually we're just going to have to browbeat everybody into compliance, and that's how we get the hyper-Bitcoinization.
That's it. Perfect place. I'm not the host here, but obviously I think that's a perfect place to wrap this one up.